Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to episode 1, season 2 of Sporting Success, How It All Began. First up is an interview with author, journalist and broadcaster John Wertheim, which we recorded in May 2020, before Novak Djokovic contracted COVID and Roger Federer announced that he was not going to play tennis competitively for the rest of the year because of knee surgery. John discusses post-pandemic tennis, the business of the sport, the differences between the haves and have-nots, and whether or not journalists can be friends with the athletes. I do hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to Sporting Success, How It All Began with Candy Reid Harrop. Have you ever wondered why some athletes make it and others don't? Why some swing to glory while equally talented men and women skid off the tracks? This is a podcast which delves into the tiny differences between success and failure in the sporting world. As a former semi-professional tennis player and sports broadcast journalist, I'll be talking to a host of interviewees to try to gain some insight into the road to glory. If you've seen tennis on television or if you've watched sports in the USA, then I think it's also likely you've either seen or heard of John Wertheim. There are journalists and there are super journalists. And John, I think it's fair to say, is the latter. And no, he didn't pay me to say that. He's written multiple books, appeared on countless radio and television stations, hosts a podcast, writes a blog / mailbag, and covers a whole host of sports. But tennis is arguably what he's most known for. John is currently an analyst for the Tennis Channel and covers all four majors. And I'm delighted to say that John is on this edition of Sporting Success. John, a very warm welcome. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you. That was a warm welcome. I never know how to answer how am I doing anymore. But I'm healthy and working and okay. So I forfeit any right to complain. But these are interesting times. Happy to be here. Happy to reconnect and happy to talk with you.
Yes, brilliant. You're on. Thank you very much. Now, I said in the lead-in, four majors, but of course, 2020 only has the possibility of three since our beloved Wimbledon has been cancelled. Do you actually think, though, that the US Open and French Open will go ahead?
That's a great question. That is a question that is absolutely consuming tennis right now. I think my answer is I think there's a better chance of one than nothing. But I don't think there will be two. And I think, I mean, the one I'm sort of fixated on is the U.S. Open, which is going to be first on the calendar. And it's in Queens, New York, which is very much the epicenter, you could argue, globally for COVID. I just don't see them pulling this off in late August. And television very much wants this to happen. And tennis fans very much want it to happen. But I just, there's so many obstacles, some of them health obstacles, some of them sort of optics and PR obstacles, and some of them just logistical. I don't know. I mean, would Roger Federer, Serena Williams, Rafa Nadal, and Novak Djokovic in three of the four cases cross an ocean? You know, three of the four of them are parents. All four of them are married. Would they cross an ocean and quarantine for 2 weeks to play in a U.S. Open in front of no fans? And if those four didn't come, is the tournament worth holding? Is TV still interested in? I mean, I don't see the U.S. Open happening as much as we all wanted. I'm more optimistic about the French Open, which, apart from everything else, is 4 or 5 weeks later in the calendar.
I think that's a very good point. Here in England, we've really benefited. Well, the LTA has, because they had, of course, that pandemic insurance, which was just a brilliant idea 18 years ago. I think they paid $1 million a year for the last 18 years, and the insurance policy came back with $100 million. So Wimbledon, the LTA, and British tennis in general has all done well. And I think that's the pressure that the US Open and perhaps the French Open is feeling, that they need that money coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it's a few things. One of them is this is how tennis in that country gets funded. There is not the, you're absolutely right. There is not an insurance policy. And also remember, Candy, that the two of those events both have these big capital projects that the U.S. Open for years and years and years would have these rainouts and everybody would groan and it would ruin the day. And now there are two covered facilities and there might be a third. Same with the French Open is now getting a roof over the big stadium. So apart from not having the insurance, they also need to sort of carry the service on this debt they have for these big capital projects.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You mentioned there that the big players might not want to play in front of no fans. Do you think sports events, any of them, can go ahead successfully behind closed doors?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a point, and I think, we're going to have to, like so much in our lives, we're going to have to adjust. And if you watched, I mean, I take it you are more civilized than this, but if you're like me and you watched Ultimate Fighting, you watched mixed martial arts, it really didn't seem that different. I mean, I think I was just telling someone a few months ago, I went in a driverless semi in a big truck with no driver. And for the first 5 minutes, you say, "Boy, this is the craziest thing." And after about 5 minutes, you say, "I don't know. It sounds like feels like I'm in a truck." And I think the same thing is going to happen in sports. If you like football, it's going to be strange that there are no fans in the stands, but it beats the alternative. And I think I think we adapt to that. I think if there's competition, if there's TV, if there's candidly an opportunity for a lot of people to wager, people can abide by not having crowd noise. I think some sports more easily than others. I mean, to me, it's just sort of a health and safety issue. And can you have, in the case of tennis, never mind the crowd, can you have, hundreds of players from all over the world, each of them with coaches and physios often, can you have them all in one facility, all in one locker room, all eating in one player services area? I think some sports are going to be more challenged than others. Tennis is going to be very challenged. And I think fans are already showing that we really like live sports and we really want live sports. And if Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal played tennis in a barn with no fans picking up their own tennis balls and we had to score it ourselves, we would still gladly tune in and watch.
Yeah, I would definitely tune in for that. Anytime either of those guys steps on a court, I'd love to see it. Now, one of the things that makes tennis so fantastic is its global appeal, isn't it? It's going to be a major obstacle in tennis restarting because of that. How do you see the tour emerging from this pandemic in the long term?
That's a great question. And the irony here is this is in other contexts, tennis is great asset, tennis is great virtue. The players come from all over, they play the sport all over the world. You have really a global product that can attract global sponsors. It's terrible for a virus. And I don't know. I mean, I think people are going to improvise for a while. I mean, they're talking about having an Australian Open and only Australians can be fans. I mean, I've heard them talking about having going back to national championships. So you will have, a Czech tournament and a German tournament and a French tournament, and you won't have to worry about players crossing borders. But this is going to be a real issue. I mean, can you hold a US Open if players from three or four countries aren't permitted to leave their country to travel there? I mean, it doesn't become an open tournament at that point. It's going to be, can you have a tournament where some players have to come and go into 2 week quarantine, but others don't, which I think we're going to have at the US Open. I mean, if this goes off as planned, the American players will be fine, but players from other countries are going to have to spend 2 weeks in their hotel room. Is that fair? So I think that tennis is really going to have some challenges here. It's going to have to be creative, which has not always been something the sport does particularly well. It actually, I think, has distinguished itself these past few months with some real sort of outside the box thinking, which is long needed. But it's very different from, I mean, again, I referenced the UFC, the fighting, where the fighters all fly in. It's one night. They all come from the same country. Most of them are American, and then they go home. That's very different from a tennis tournament. If God forbid someone tested positive of this US Open we're envisioning on day three, this is a 14-day tournament. What do we do for the next 11 days? So tennis is going to have some real challenges to confront in the next few months here.
And speaking of out of the box challenges, on a previous podcast, I actually spoke to the BBC's golf correspondent Ian Carter on a possible global golf tour. That's something that Roger Federer questioned, isn't it? Whether the tennis tours could merge. Something I think would be great and I would love to see happen, but I don't think it will because I think there's too many hurdles. What's your take on it?
Yeah, this is the merging of the men's and women's tour you're talking about. I mean, it
Correct.
makes all sorts of sense. Buyers like scale. It would be easier for the fans. It would be easier and more lucrative for television contracts. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons. I think there also are all sorts of reasons why this isn't a new idea. I mean, it's been bandied about for decades now. I think the big question people have are, is this because the men and their new ATP leadership are willing to really think of this as a unified tour, a unified sport, or the sort of conspiracy theory is that women's tennis is really going to be in trouble financially if it can't pull off this Asian swing this fall. So is this a merger or an acquisition? And nobody really has the answer. I think it's a healthy discussion. I'm glad Roger Federer brought it up, but I think like you, it's a lot easier to send a tweet saying, hey, we ought to do this together than to sit in the room and negotiate what exactly is this joint sport going to look like.
Absolutely. And I know they are talking very much about that Asian tour and the women's game. And of course, once Serena Williams goes, well, how will that impact the tour? There's a lot of money in tennis, but it is mainly at the top. Do you think that we'll see prize money filter down a bit more once things are up and running, or will it retain the status quo?
That's a great question, because I think people are seeing that there really is this income inequality, and that Roger Federer, Serena Williams, Nadal, I mean, these athletes may retire as billionaires, and yet the player on the other side of the net might be unsure how they're going to pay their bills through the rest of the year. At the same time, you know, the market is the market at some level. And one thing about tennis is I think the athletes operate on the assumption that, unlike other sports where most of the money is in the contracts and the salaries, in tennis, if you're a top tennis player, the bulk of your money is going to come from off the court. So I think prize money is part of it. And yeah, if the winner of the Australian Open had made $2 million instead of $3.5 million, everybody goes home happy, it would be fine. But I still think you're going to have this income inequality where the stars in this global sport and these sort of, I mean, tennis players usually don't come with much baggage. There's no reason not to sign Roger Federer, Serena Williams, or, you know, now Coco Gauff to these large contracts. The top players are always going to have much more wealth, which also means more resources, right? So Roger Federer can hire trainers and he'll never have to go to an airport. And he will, if his back hurts, he hires a back specialist. And the player on the other side of the net may be sort of a paycheck to paycheck guy. So I think that's always going to be something that's, and it's getting, you know, it's getting more profound. That's always going to impact tennis.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's almost a case of the rich getting richer, isn't it? And the poor getting poorer. I think the general consensus is that men have to be in the top 150 in the world to make any decent money. And women have to be in the top 250 in the world. And we all know how tough being top 250 in the world is and how much goes into it. I mean, it's a real job and it's almost like winning the lottery to get there.
Yeah, exactly. And there are no guarantees. I mean, in other sports I cover, you may not be a great player, but every other Friday that check is going to hit your account. I mean, if you're number 200 in the world, a couple of bad months and suddenly you're not sure how you're going to pay your coach. I mean, the flip side to all this is sometimes I feel like we sort of lose sight of the economics. You know, I always say Los Angeles is crawling with waiters and waitresses who are waiting for their big break. And there are plenty of, you know, musicians who are playing weddings and aren't Taylor Swift and Adele. Maybe tennis can only accommodate a certain number of players. And there's this new sort of relief fund for a lot of the players who are out of work. And they're talking about how many players should benefit. And, you know, that's right now it looks to be about 700 players. So if you're in the top 100, you don't get anything. But after about the top 100, everybody gets part of this relief fund. And part of me says this is all very altruistic and it's something we should all be supportive of. But I don't know, maybe tennis can't accommodate 700 people. I mean, maybe the sport just isn't that big. So I think that there is this huge income inequality, but I think sometimes we lose sight of, you know, every field has that. There are plenty of lawyers have yachts and plenty of lawyers aren't sure if they're going to be able to make rent. So at some level, it sounds harsh to say it, but maybe there are only so many players that can be accommodated as professionals in this sport. I think that's something the sport sort of has to reckon with a little better.
Yeah, that's a good point. And business, the smaller businesses sometimes fail. I suppose it's market forces at work. Now, when researching your background for this podcast, I came across the podcast that you host. And just recently, you spoke to Maria Sharapova's agent, Max Eisenbud. It really was a fascinating interview. I've met many agents. Actually, my brother is a golf agent, and they do vary considerably, as I'm sure you know. It's easy to see why Max is so successful. What stood out for you while talking to him?
So this was sort of part two of an interview. I mean, sort of in full disclosure, we've known each other forever and have considerable rapport over the last 20 years or so. And I think that's one thing about tennis too, that in other sports, I mean, I have friends that cover teams and they may go a season without talking to the star athlete or to the coach. I mean, in tennis sort of, it gets very small, very fast. And I think part of it is the scale, but part of it also is the context, and you're seeing people all over the world and you're on flights together and you're in cars together. It's one reason why I enjoy covering the sport, that you really have relationships with the principals. But no, I mean, I think, you know, agents come in all sorts of different MOs. And I think Max sort of knows who he is and he knows his strengths and he's very loyal to his clients. I mean this in the best possible way. This is not Jerry Maguire, but as I think you could probably tell from that podcast, I don't know if you heard which one. We did two in part because people wrote in. They said, oh my God, you got to have this guy back. I didn't realize he had this much to say for himself. And who knew? He's, you know, a straight shooter, as we say. And I think the fact that his clients are as loyal to him as they are speaks well of him. And, you know, I mean, I think we all go into this wide open. I mean, sometimes agents have to make tough decisions and there are things they can't disclose. And I think most agents and most media, if they're doing it right, they realize that interests aren't always going to be aligned. But if there's a sort of level of mutual respect, you appreciate that and go from there. But no, I enjoyed that conversation, both conversations with Max. And I mean, again, all agents sort of work in different ways and have different MOs and inflection points. And it's, at some level, it's a sales job. But at some level, as he was very clear about, it's also sort of a service job. Again, I think people like certain agents and don't like others. I think ultimately it's about the clients and the fact that, you know, Maria Sharapova, Lord knows she had many opportunities to make an agent change. The fact that she and Lina and Madison Keys, I mean, I think at some level, your client's loyalty is really the ultimate validation.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think that's a very good point. You mentioned there about tennis being such a small sport, everyone seems to know each other. Do you find it hard to criticize athletes, given that you have to interview them all the time? Because it can make for some awkward conversations, can't
it? Yeah, I guess I would say to that, yes and no. I mean, I think it's if you do that, you're not doing your job. I mean, it's sort of professional malpractice to bite your tongue. I think the one thing I would say is you think twice and you think about how you deliver your criticisms when, you know, these aren't just people on Twitter or people that fans talk about. They're people that you run into and you see them on a Tuesday night on the back court and you see them limp off the court. And then when they're asked about their injuries, they say, I was 100% fine. I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I think you sort of get these behind the curtain looks, and it doesn't insulate anyone from criticism. But I think what it does do is it makes you think twice about how you express your criticism. And I think, you know, I mean, again, I think there is a sense, a little bit of family might be a bit of a cliche and maybe a bit of an oversimplification, but I do think there is a sense of sort of, we're all in this together. We all want the sport to thrive. And if Nick Kyrgios tanks a match, nobody's going to say that was a heroic performance. But I do think it does have that sort of family aspect where you think about how you manage relationships and how you deliver your criticism. And I mean, I think you have to be professional about it, but I also think you can have some empathy and realize that these ultimately are people just trying to do their job.
You can be friends, like you said, with the agents, perhaps, and obviously your co-commentators and co-journalists. Can you ever be friendly with the players?
Great question. I would say friendly, not friends. And, you know, I mean, I'm in my late 40s. I mean, I don't, Coco Gauff and I, you know, Coco Gauff's my children's age. So I think it's, but you know, when you start out, though, there's a real, you're the same age. I mean, I started in this in my mid-20s, and you're the same age of the players, and sometimes you have mutual friends and you're listening to the same music. And I think it's a little bit easy to get sucked into that. That's kind of a no-no. I think you just want, I mean, at one point I even had that with I guess I can say it now since we're, I once had a, you know, a bit of a passionate discussion with Andy Roddick. And at one point I said, look, I don't want to be your friend. We're not friends here. I mean, he sort of said it as I'd written something and he felt a sense of betrayal. And I sort of said, look, you know, I'm not here to be your friend. And that's not the goal. I got my own set of friends. And I think friendly is what you aim for, and you'd like there to be respect. You'd like there to be accessibility. It's nice that, you know, you can pick up the phone and call Andy Roddick and have an adult conversation. It's a bit of a balance, but I do think you need to sort of keep work and pleasure separate. But it also it's nice to have, I don't say social like go out, but it's nice to have civil relations with the people you cover, and it's nice to be able to have some meaningful talks about them, and sometimes they're on the record and sometimes they're off the record, and sometimes, you know, I think it's okay to catch up with people and have dinner with them, but I do think it's very easy and I think can be a little bit compromising to go too far down that road of being friends beyond being friendly. How's that for a Mealy Mouth fan?
Yeah, no, well, I think you're right. There's definitely a fine line, and I think once you cross it, it's very tricky to come back. Let's focus a bit more on your career. Were you a big sports fan growing up?
Yeah, I would say so. I grew up in the middle of the country, in the middle of the United States, and it was sort of a social necessity as much as anything. You were a boy, and that's what you were into. So I wasn't like a super fan, but I was pretty into sports. Yeah, especially basketball.
Oh, I know you cover basketball amongst some other sports, but you I really know you for tennis. So why tennis in particular?
I started at Sports Illustrated magazine and was encouraged to write profiles and do investigations, but I was encouraged to find one sport to specialize in, and it didn't have to be full time, but just have one sport you could sort of anchor. And someone said, you know, why not tennis? They basically said that the travel is great and everybody's crazy, which wasn't a half bad scouting report. I had always liked tennis. I worked at an ATP event when I was in college and university in the early 90s, and so I always liked the sport, and it really has been such a fun sport to cover for that reason. You know, I would say it's older and younger and men and women, and, you know, the Williams sisters and Roger Federer, Serena and Roger Federer were born a few weeks apart. They could not be more different. And you really do get to have relationships with the people in the cast. I've loved it. A lot of people get jaded covering a sport. If anything, I'm sort of more enthusiastic about tennis today than I was when I started 20 plus years ago. It's got its challenges, but I think it's ultimately sort of a force of good. I really sort of got hooked on tennis.
And you like it so much, you wrote an entire book on the 2008 Wimbledon men's final between Federer and Nadal, which I very much enjoyed, I must say. Is that truly the best match you've ever seen?
It is. But I'll tell you the funny story. Someone had asked me if I could do would I be interested? This was like in 2007. They said, could you do a book on Roger Federer? He's a dominant player, and American audiences may not appreciate him, but worldwide, he sure seems like a popular guy. And I went to the Federer camp, and they were great and basically said, yeah, Roger has no interest in doing a book, but if you want to do it, we're not going to stop you, which is exactly what you want to hear. I mean, I had no interest in sort of ghostwriting Roger Federer's book, but I also didn't want them to say, if you do this, you're dead to us. So they gave me this ideal response of like, you know, we're not going to endorse it, but go knock yourself out if you want to do it. And so I was thrilled. And then the year started at the Australian Open. And I don't know if you recall this, a skinny kid from Serbia beats Roger Federer. And that was, of course, Novak Djokovic. And then at the French Open, Roger Federer makes it to the final. And then he gets destroyed by Nadal. And I'm thinking, oh, this book, as Roger Federer won his last major. You know, remember, this is an age where tennis players peaked in their mid-20s. And by their late 20s, they were, you know, often very much on the decline. And then that Wimbledon final with Nadal happened. And after two sets, I said, there goes my book contract. And so much, no one's going to even, Roger Federer has been dethroned. And a few hours later, we had a five-setter. And I'm thinking, I may be able to salvage this thing after all. So that book was really, started out as something very different than what it ended up as. But to your question, yes, that's the best match I've ever seen. I don't know how much that's challenged, but I think given Federer, Nadal, it's one, two, lefty, righty, Wimbledon, finals, five, I mean, sort of put it all together, the context, the match itself, the quality of play, the winners to errors, the Nadal winning in the very last game before the event had to be called on account of darkness. I mean, you sort of put it all together, and yeah, I would stand by that being the greatest match ever, even whatever we are 10, 12 years later.
I don't think very many people would disagree. It was absolutely tremendous. Who do you think will benefit from this extended break?
And I think we are all waiting to see what this reveals. A lot of people are having this discussion, and I feel like you can, for every argument for, there's an argument con, and it would stand to reason that the older players suffer, but right now Serena Williams, Roger Federer, even Nadal, they need opportunities. They need majors to keep trying to win. And, you know, their school's not in session. And yet at the same time, they know what it's like to go through these periods of inactivity, whether it's injuries or in Serena's case, maybe there was a little bit of burnout, there was motherhood. Well, as we talked about, they're wealthy enough so that they have fitness trainers and home gyms, and they can really do a lot more to stay in shape. No, I talked to, I guess a few months ago now, to Vasek Pospisil, who's, you know, a good player and was in the top 25, but he hasn't won majors, and he was stranded in his apartment in Vancouver, Canada. And I'm thinking, you know, Roger Federer has an indoor gym and Rafa Nadal has his own academy. They're going to be, in all likelihood, a lot more prepared to resume tennis when it comes time than a guy who's doing push-ups and sit-ups in his one-bedroom apartment in Vancouver. So I don't know. I mean, I think this probably benefits the younger players, but if you're 16-year-old Coco Gauff, maybe you're not prepared for this. I just, it's going to be really interesting to see. And I don't think, someone asked me this, and I think the answer is no. They said, do you think any players have just let themselves go? You know, Nick Kyrgios was put on 50 pounds of weight and hasn't stopped playing video games. I mean, I think players are staying in shape for the most part, but I think it's going to be really interesting to see who is sharp and who isn't, because you can prepare to rehab a knee injury and you can prepare to take a few months off to recover mentally, but nobody's been through anything like this before.
And also, nobody knows when everything's going to start again. So that's another tricky one. Now, from my perspective, your career goes from strength to strength. I remember working for CNN, and if we ever needed anyone to come on and talk tennis, we always came to you, John, and you were always very willing. Thank you very much. In a tennis match, there are usually turning points. And I was just wondering about whether there have been any turning points
Oh
in
man,
your career.
I mean, media obviously looks very different than it did when I started. I mean, honestly, some of these CNN hits with you of, oh wait, this TV thing isn't so scary after all, and it's actually kind of fun to condense your thoughts and to try and say something coherent in a limited amount of time, which that's very different than writing, and yet at the same time, you're still conveying information and trying to be a little bit entertaining. I mean, I guess, you know, now I've been doing a lot of non-sports at 60 Minutes. And, you know, at one point, someone at 60 Minutes stated, originally I started there doing sports stories, and they said to me, you know, would you ever think about doing non-sports? And for 20 years, I, you know, tried to be fairly versatile in sports and tried to do a variety. I never wanted to be the guy who went to, you know, 160 baseball games, or I never wanted to do only one sport. I mean, as much as I love tennis, it was basically sort of the four majors and maybe Indian Wells. So I still had, you know, 40 weeks to do other stuff. But I think a few years ago when I started doing non-sports, in some ways, you know, a story is a story and an interview is an interview, and you still are trying to build rapport and ask the right questions. I mean, in some ways it's exactly the same skill set, and in some ways it's completely different. But I would say, you know, at some level, you sort of have to go where, what did the British bank robber, what did that Willie Sutton say? Why do you rob banks? And he said, you have to go where the money is. That sounds a little crass, but at some level, you have to go where, you know, I mean, being a full-time magazine writer is probably not where you necessarily, except in a few exceptions, want to be in 2020. So at some level, I've sort of just had to go where the train's gone. And that means more video and podcast, you know, you as well. I mean, podcasting, and it's different modes of telling stories, and writing is always at the core. But, you know, at some level, this is a very, very different media world than the one I entered in the late 90s. And you sort of just have to roll with it at some level.
Yeah, you've got to be very versatile, and you do everything so well and with such good grace. That's the positive side of your career. Have you made any mistakes which you regret,
Oh,
perhaps?
geez. Yeah, I mean, too many to count. Yeah, absolutely. I filled with regrets, and some of them are small. We all have sort of written columns we wish we could take back, or we've asked stupid questions that we wish we could retract. Some of them are much more sort of macro. What would have happened if I had done X? I mean, at one point, I had a chance to sort of be Sports Illustrated's main basketball writer. How would my career have looked differently? I mean, I do think, I was just telling my kids this. I mean, I do think most of the regrets are opportunities squandered, things I didn't do, and not proactive mistakes. So, yeah, you wish you hadn't written a stupid column, or you wish you had asked a better question. But most of the regrets, I don't know if you're the same way. I mean, most of the regrets are sort of, you know, a book someone suggested that I never pursued writing, or an assignment that I turned down and wish I hadn't turned down. I mean, I think most of the regrets are sort of regrets of omission and not commission.
And sometimes making a decision like that leads to another decision
That's true.
which actually
That's
works in
no,
your
that's a
favor.
no. Yeah, right. Especially in this profession where every week brings another assignment. Yeah, these things don't, it's a really good point. These things don't get made in a vacuum. But yeah, God, lots of mistakes though, to your to your question. Lots of regrets and lots of mistakes.
I think unfortunately we all have those. Now, having watched thousands of tennis matches and interviewed hundreds of athletes, what do you think actually separates the best from the
That is
rest?
a great question, and I just don't know. I mean, I don't know if you're watching if these Michael Jordan documentaries have made their way to the UK, but you get
Hmm.
a you get a real sense of sort of what drove Michael Jordan. And I've been thinking about that in terms of tennis, and I'm thinking like Roger Federer is wired nothing like this. So I mean, I think it's easy to say, oh, they have a single-minded focus, or they have ways of motivating themselves, but I don't know. I mean, I've seen Roger Federer before a huge final go out to practice, and he's doesn't even watch where he stands when he serves, and someone yells his name, and he turns around, and he poses for photos, and he signs autographs, and then he goes and plays this absolutely beautiful, intense, focused, meticulous three sets of tennis. So it really fascinates me, but I think it's so personal and so case by case, and what works for Serena Williams doesn't work for Rafa Nadal, and what works for Michael Jordan doesn't work for Usain Bolt. I mean, I just think, I guess, well, one thing I'd say is that athletes know themselves, and Roger Federer knows that if he started talking trash or if he punched walls, it wouldn't be true to his character. And Michael Jordan probably knew, conversely, that if he signed autographs and looked like he was going out for a happy shoot around half an hour before the biggest game of his career, that would reflect well on him. So I think some of it is sort of this level of self-knowledge. But I really feel like, as much as we try to find secret ingredients and crack codes, greatness in athletes is very, very personal.
And I think Roger Federer is such an amazing character. I've heard him answer questions, the most ridiculous questions, with a straight face and just in a very nice manner, where I've heard Andy Roddick answer that same question in the most sarcastic manner, and probably one that the rest of us would do so in. But Federer is just a unique person, and I think that's probably why he's so popular. Do you think top athletes like Andy Murray, and I'm thinking about the documentary he was in recently, do you think top athletes can ever sit back and think, that's enough? I'm just going to take it easy now.
Again, the lame answer is it depends. I mean, I think individual sports are really tough, right? That even Michael Jordan, you get a little older, you change your role, maybe you don't play as many minutes, or maybe, every team sport seems to have this way for the stars to sort of gracefully downshift. I mean, if Roger Federer's playing singles, he's either winning or losing. There's no sort of, you only have to play 24 minutes, and you don't have to play so physically, and we're going to change your position a little bit. I mean, I think in an individual sport, you're either there or you're not. I mean, Andy Roddick, I was talking to him recently, and I think he was like number 18 in the world when he retired. And part of you says there are only 17 people on the planet that do your job better than you do. That's a strange time to walk away. And he sort of said, look, if it's not there and I'm not playing at the level I'm accustomed to, there's no reason to do it. And I think the other part of your question, I think it's really fascinating how athletes handle their retirement. And some of them will never replicate the feeling and the wealth and the emotions and the rush that they get when they compete. And they really struggle with that. I remember talking to Monica Seles once, and I said, well, how do you replicate all that intensity? And she said, what do you mean? I don't. I bake cookies. I don't know. I mean, I think some people say, listen, that was a phase in my life, and I'm ready for what comes next. And I think other athletes really struggle with exactly what you say, that sort of they still have this urge, and it must really be strange to say, like, these experiences and this travel and these rhythms and my popularity and my bank account, all this peaked when I was 28. And now I have 50 years to figure out what the hell am I going to do to replicate this. And a lot of them never can. But again, I mean, there are plenty of, and some of them. Some athletes make spectacular messes of their lives after they play, and others sort of say, all right, time for the next chapter. And I'm lucky. A lot of times I have a financial cushion, and I'm happy to. I mean, I work a lot with Lindsay Davenport, who won three majors, and she's a Hall of Famer. And I think it's so admirable how she's still in tennis, and she still broadcasts, and she does a little coaching. But she also said, you know what? I got a husband, I got four kids, I have friends, I'm ready for sort of chapter 2.0. And some athletes transition very gracefully, and there are other athletes that you can tell, and not just in tennis, obviously. I mean, there are other athletes you can tell are just living this life thinking, my life has peaked. and it's not always so comfortable to watch.
Yeah, Lindsay Davenport always seems like a very sort of stable figure. And I remember watching Marion Bartoli practice with her dad in the most intense tennis session I've ever seen. It was 2 hours and they didn't talk to each other. It was just whack, whack, whack. And then we did an interview with them afterwards. And I've never met two more relaxed people in my life. It was just such a different way of thinking. And I suppose you need that off the court and on the court persona to actually survive afterwards. Is there anything job-wise you'd like to do? Because you've done so much, or is there anyone you haven't interviewed that you'd like to?
Oh man, that's a good question. No, I mean, there are always books you wish you had time to write. I mean, it's somebody at some point, I think, will do a real Williams family and Serena in particular. Someone will do a real treatment, a real sort of journalistic treatment. And that doesn't mean critical, but I feel like as popular as Serena Williams in particular is, there still are levels upon levels that have never been sort of revealed and discussed, and she's been asked about. And it's not an expose. I mean, she's a figure who is to be admired, and I can't imagine a rigorous treatment of her would change that. But I feel like she's someone that's as popular as she is, she's still very much there are layers there that have not been explored. I mean, if you had Serena Williams 2 hours and truth serum, I think you'd learn a lot.
Well, I for one would love to read that book, and John, you would make the perfect author. John Wertheim, thank you so much for coming on Sporting Success. It's been really lovely hearing how it all began for you and getting your insight on the world of tennis in particular. Let's see if the US Open does indeed go ahead. Thank you so much. Thank you very much for listening to Sporting Success. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, I would love it if you would share and subscribe. See you next time.